Benjamin Franklin was our country's first Postmaster General. I wonder how he'd react to the current problems U.S. Postal Service is faced with. It's announced plans to eliminate Saturday mail delivery and reduce the number of postal processing facilities from 461 to 232 because last year it lost $16 billion and defaulted twice on its mandatory payments to the federal government. It's said to lose $25 million every day. So we thought we would take a look at mail delivery on today's Please Explain, how the Postal Service came into being and the incredible complexities of delivering the U.S. mail all over the world. Joining us are Richard John, a historian of communications, the author of Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse, and Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. They're both published by Harvard University Press. And Nancy Pope is with us. She is the History Department Curator at the Smithsonian National Postal Museum. Among over two dozen exhibits she's curated is the museum's newest, Systems at Work, which traces the evolution of mail processing from 1800 to the present. And as always during these segments, we invite you to participate by giving us a call at 212-433-9692. Or you can write to us through our show page at WNYC.org. Richard, can you tell us a bit about the history of our postal service in this country? After Ben Franklin became Postmaster General, then what happened?
Well, the key event in the early history of the post office came in 1792 when Congress declared that access to mail was to be not a privilege but a right. And in order to make that institutionalized, in order to realize that goal, Congress made it very easy to establish new post routes, creating an enormous network. It also facilitated the circulation of a particular class of mail, mail dealing with information on public affairs, primarily newspapers. And last but not least, it declared that privacy was to be a norm. That is to say, that no government administrator would be able to open anyone's personal correspondence. So it's 1792 that the modern institution began to take shape.
So, Nancy, was it a government agency at the start?
It has been, yes, from the start, part of the federal government. In fact, it had more employees at the beginning than anybody, including the military.
But today it isn't really, it's expected to be self-sufficient. When did that happen?
That was a change that happened in 1970 with the Postal Reorganization Act, changing from the old Post Office Department that was a cabinet-level position in the government to, well, what people most easily call a quasi-governmental organization, which it is today.
Now, can you clear something up for me? Because in reading about Postal Service, I come upon U.S. Mail, the United States Post Office, the United States Postal Service. Are they all the same thing?
You forgot the Post Office Department and the General Post Office. They are essentially the same entity. It's just a question of how it is organized in the government.
Where did our image of the intrepid postman or woman come from?
Well, that's really been from the postal supervisors that have insisted on a regular basis that mail has to get there as quickly as possible. And that would be, they're insisting that for their employees. They're insisting that for the contractors that are working with them. And, you know, in the New York City, of course, the Farley Post Office building has that great quotation, "Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds." And you put something like that up on a public building, people start to notice.
Although it's the post office hasn't always lived up to that motto. I've had my own experiences.
There have been a lot of challenges over the centuries.
So, Richard, let's talk about some of the challenges. The early days, obviously, mail was carried by horse or shipped off to other countries in transatlantic boats. But how important have the technological turning points been over the years?
Well, the post office has been an innovator and a catalyst for innovation in a number of distinct moments. the 19th century stagecoach industry. We think of the stagecoach industry in the West, but there was a thriving stagecoach industry in the East, and it was largely subsidized by the post office. When the post office stopped subsidizing it, it disappeared. Railroad, less so, but with the coming of airplanes, government once again was a major funder. In fact, the O'Hare Airport, Chicago, I used to live in Chicago, O'Hare Airport became important originally because Chicago was a railway mail center, so circulation of the mail then made it a logical place to start funding contracts for air service. So the airplane business, commercial airlines, got a major impetus from the post office. And in more recent years, the post office has been very important in optical scanning and in all kinds of electronic technologies to sort and facilitate the movement of the mail. So it's been important for a long time.
The Postal Service has to cover a wide area with the United States. There are a few other countries that are large, like Canada, Russia. Are we a major innovator because we had to deal with the fact that there's a big expanse between the East Coast and the West Coast?
Yeah, that's a great question. The size of the country is important, but it's by no means the key factor. The key factor was the commitment of lawmakers to make access to information on public affairs and information on commerce, too, accessible. So, for example, when Alexis de Tocqueville came to the United States in 1831, he was astonished at the size of the network, which was much bigger than the network in France, which was a big country in Europe at the time. So it wasn't simply a matter of geography or even simply a matter of technology. It was the civic mandate of the institution to make access to information a right and not a privilege that helps to explain why the institution became so big and remains so big. I was just looking at some statistics. About 40% of the world's mail today is sent through the U.S. Post Office. So geography matters, but geography is not the whole story.
Nancy, since the Postal Service still remains an important way for people to connect to each other, why were things changed in 1970?
Well, basically, after World War II, you had this great influx of mail volume that came, you know, as the guys were coming back, moving to the suburbs, starting families, starting new businesses. Population is growing. And with that, mail volume just starts growing like crazy. Companies started using mail more and more for businesses they had in the past, but it's starting to be, you know, even more important to advertising. So mail volume starts to overwhelm the post office department, which in the 1950s is kind of operating with the same equipment, technology, and systems for the most part that they've had since the 20s and 30s. Because of the Depression, because of World War II, there's not a lot of money put into modernizing postal systems. So you have Arthur Summerfield, who's a postmaster general in the 50s, trying his best to turn this all around and basically make the automated systems work as best as they can, bring in new machinery, mechanized machinery, start basically redoing the entire processing of mail. And while he's trying to do this, he's playing catch-up. And in the 1960s, it's still a problem. And in 1966, in Richard's hometown, Chicago, there's a big problem when basically there's so much mail that it shuts down the Chicago Post Office.
When you shut down
the Chicago Post Office, you're going to start shutting down everything that's all the mail that's going in and out from other cities. So this makes the national news. This is a huge problem. And that's when the government, which is to this point, you know, considering that we need to do something, Congress is kind of red-faced about we have to do something. And so they do what they always do. They create a commission. And this Capel Commission takes a few years to kind of come up with the idea of what a newly formed system should be, and that's what's inaugurated in 1971, the act being signed by Richard Nixon in August of that year, and that's the Post Office Reorganization Act.
So it's semi-privatization, Richard.
Yeah, that's a wonderful summary that Nancy's given us, and just two small additional thoughts. The first is that As late as the New Deal, and certainly into the 1950s, the post office was a major source of political patronage for the for the two parties. So the idea of privatizing the post office was not something that the party in power would have supported. And that second, that only in the 1960s do you begin to get influential spokespeople like Capel and his commission contending that a private enterprise model could be better than a public enterprise model for the post office. And in fact, that is a critical kind of cultural ideological shift that makes possible the 1970 reorganization.
And another key is the 1970 postal strike, mm-hmm. which happens in New York, starts in New York as a wildcat strike that spreads across the country. And that's happening because at this point, postal workers are really being paid very, very little. The unions are not all that strong. They can't really get what they need. And so the postal strike spreading across the country also brings a lot of points home about how this post office department is really just poorly organized at this point.
Was it already facing serious competition from FedEx and other private delivery systems?
There have always been private delivery systems for packages and non-first-class mail. But the post office department really has that, what they call the monopoly on the letter mail and the first-class mail. And so they've been strong on that. It really wasn't the competitors at that point. It was more the fact that they just did not have the machinery, equipment, and the organizational systems that they needed.
In fact, Capel had been the CEO of AT&T, and AT&T back in those days, Bell System, was not an organization that was very enthusiastic about competition, so competition was not proposed as a solution to the problems that faced the post office in 1970.
Go ahead, continue.
Competition would become an issue, but only later.
Mike from Sheepshead Bay, you wanted to get into this conversation?
Yeah, I just wanted to find out if it's my proper recollection that providing for a postal service is part of the U.S. Constitution, and wouldn't an amendment to the Constitution be required if the U.S. government was going to go out of the postal service or postal business? I believe it's right there in the Constitution if somebody would Google it, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. The post office is written into the Constitution. In fact, it's the only business that is written into the Constitution, and it has been protected under a panoply of laws throughout its history. So were lawmakers to propose privatizing the post office or perhaps to permit the Germans to buy it out, you would have a constitutional crisis of sorts. But one of the things that intrigues me about the current debate over the problems of the post office is how few voices in Congress are calling out for the privatization of the post office. This was not an issue during our presidential campaign. A candidate, Romney, wanted to privatize Big Bird, but not the post office.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Richard John, who is the author of Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse, and another book, Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications, both published by Harvard University Press. Nancy Pope is the History Department curator at the Smithsonian National Postal Museum. The latest exhibit she has curated is Systems at Work, currently at the museum. It traces the evolution of mail processing from 1800 to the present. We'll be back right after this. We're back with our Please Explain look at the Postal Service with Nancy Pope of the Smithsonian and Robert John, a historian of communications. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write us at WNYC.org. Now, before we get to the calls, I want to get down to real basics, and I throw this out to both of you. What happens when I drop my letter at that mailbox on my corner? How does it wind up going somewhere else? I want to quote what someone from the post office we spoke to yesterday said about what the Postal Service can do. She said, for the price of a first-class stamp, you can mail a letter from the U.S. Virgin Islands to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, where we deliver it by muleback and have it forwarded for free to north of the Arctic Circle, where we use hovercraft to navigate frozen rivers, or as far west as Guam. Now, most letters don't go through that, but what happens when I put a letter in the mailbox and it's going to go across the street? How complicated is that route?
Well, whether it's across the street or across the country, there are certain basic things that are going to happen. And you're right, you know, for us, the postal system, it's really, it carries this illusion of simplicity. You know, we see that we put the mail in by hand, somebody brings it to us by hand. Magic, right? Simple. But really what's behind that are these gigantic, huge buildings called processing centers that are full of equipment that in some cases is the size of a football field. And when you drop your letter into the mail, it's going to go into one of these, and it's going to go through a massive processing system where the letters and the magazines and the packages are all split up. There's special machinery for each type of mail. So the letters, for instance, will go through what they call a facer-canceller operation first. All the envelopes are whipped around so that the stamps are in the same place. And they can do that through stamp phosphor tagging that's on each stamp. So then they go shooting through the machines. The stamps are canceled by machine. The address is read by a handwriting recognition software. And then once that matches software address that they've got in their database, the machine's spraying a barcode on it. And that barcode basically is the key to everything else that's going to happen. So for your letter that just goes across the street, it will then be put into the letter carrier that his or her trays that will do that. It will be basically with all the other letters that he or she carries on the route, but in the order that they go through the route. If you're sending a letter from New York to San Francisco, it's going to go onto a plane, go down to San Francisco into a processing plant where there it will be forwarded to the trays that carrier has. So the key to everything is this huge plant and all this machinery. And I invite everybody to either come to the museum or check out our Systems of at Work video where you can see this happening, and it's amazing.
And, Richard, should I assume that similar things happen when the letter winds up in Paris or London or Moscow?
Yeah, the United States entered into international agreements to facilitate the conveyance of the mail beginning in the second half of the 19th century. In fact, the United States Postmaster General was a pioneer in convening the first international assembly of postal administrators that led to the Universal Postal Union. Until that time, it was kind of catch-as-catch-can, and you'd have arrangements with merchants. But certainly from the 1870s on, there has been an international organization, one of the first in the world, to coordinate the movement of mail. And before that time, a letter would have many, many postal markings and different stamps, but gradually it's been standardized, enormously facilitating communication.
Well, what's going to happen with when the number of postal processing facilities is reduced from 461 to 232? Have we seen a major drop in the volume of mail that would allow that to be done efficiently?
Well, this is a question for postal administrators and for policymakers. One reason we've had so many of these sorting stations is to speed up the movement of the mail. So you can get your mail in 1 day, 2 days, very quick turnaround. And there's going to be a slowing in the delivery of mail if we cut down on the number of sorting centers. That's the main immediate consequence, and it's possible those institutions can be mothballed until revenue picks up. But it's mostly the speed of the mail, and there is a policy question here: to what extent is that important? Getting a letter in 1 day, in 2 days, or even a parcel, say something from Amazon or Netflix.
Nancy, even though the U.S. Postal Service is self-financing, at least in theory, Congress gets involved. Isn't there legislation that's passed the Senate but that's been held up in the House?
Yes, indeed. This last year, the Senate actually passed a form of a postal bill that would give some changes, not anything truly dramatic that is quite honestly needed. And the House could not get its bill passed. ICE's bill was the closest that came to passing, but they couldn't get it together. And so no reconciliation, and they get to start all over this year.
We have a call from John from Paramus. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have 2 points. What do you think the possibility of the elimination of Saturday mail, will that come? Is that in the future? And don't you think the stamps should be at least a dollar? I mean, in today's modern age, I just bought 2 stamps yesterday for 90 cents. I mean, a dollar is the way inflation is and everything else. I think the postage should be at least a dollar for it.
Well, the price is going up, isn't it?
The price goes up. He makes two very good points to address the second one. A dollar is not too much for the work that's done, but because the most rapidly falling sector of the mail volume is letters, first-class mail, which is not just letters, bills, all of that, that's kind of moving to the online world, they don't want to do anything that will increase that rate of decline. And moving from, 45 cents now to a dollar, that would make some businesses basically run from the post office and run onto online faster than they are now.
And online is a major cause of all these problems, isn't it? People
it is
now
for bills. It's not so much for the first class letters, and it's certainly not for packages, because you have to have somebody to bring you that sweater from that you're ordering from Amazon.com.
On the other hand, I keep on being encouraged by pretty much everybody, my bank and anybody else I have to deal with, to do all of my transactions online rather than put the check in the mail.
And the post office is aggressively moving into the digital space, but there are legal questions as to whether it'll be permitted to move into that space. And certainly there are administrators in the post office and in the postal regulatory commission that see the digital space as a very a promising future, not only because it could provide the kind of service that we've grown accustomed to from the post office, but it also might provide certain security safeguards that are woefully lacking in non-postal digital services.
Miriam from Manhattan, you're on the air.
I was only addressing the question of increasing the cost of sending junk mail, and maybe thereby saving paper and getting less junk mail.
You just want to get rid of the junk mail. But have there been proposals to raise the price for junk mail?
There are proposals to change prices on a regular basis, but the Post Office Department, the U.S. Postal Service, they're not in charge of their rates. Rates are basically set through the Postal Regulatory and Postal Rate Commission, Regulatory Commission is now, the PRC. And the PRC hears testimony from every group under the sun that has a dog in the fight. And so you have businesses, you have nonprofit mailers, everybody that's sending what we call our junk mail, but what for them is, you know, business mail, and they're all fighting to keep their costs low and raise somebody else's, you know, either packages or first class. So it's up to the PRC each time to kind of balance all these needs and make sure that it works for everybody.
Let's go to Jonathan from Manhattan. Hi, Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I just have to say, I think anyone who's used mail should be almost required to go to the museum. I've been to the museum, and it's probably one of the best ones I've ever been to. And I live in Manhattan, and lots of museums available to me. But I'd send all my friends to the museum when they go to Washington, because it's just so thorough, covers so many things, and really makes you appreciate the effort.
What were you surprised to learn?
Excuse me?
What were you surprised to learn?
I think just the complication and getting, like you said, a letter from across the street to across the country, the amount of effort it takes, and what kind of machinery it takes, and the effort again to do that type of thing. Of course, I think seeing the stuffed dog Oni was kind of strange, but other than that, the all the different aspects of fraud and moving the mail and the history of it. It's fascinating.
Well, thank you for calling. Now, there are problems sometimes. Every once in a while, it happened just recently, I will be told that I didn't pay a bill that I thought I paid. I mailed it out. How much mail is lost? And a listener wonders how much mail was lost as a result of Hurricane Sandy.
Well, there's mail that is lost just in the daily operations of moving everything through all those machines. You'll see people whose jobs it is basically to come through at the end of a run and try and find, you know, any mail that's gotten tossed out by the machines. But when you're looking at all of that automation and all of that stuff, you know, it's one of those things happen. On the other hand, mail loss because of a disaster, natural or man-made, that actually becomes the territory of a little-known group called the U.S. Postal Inspectors. And they're the ones who are sent down to investigate and see what's, you know, what mail loss may have occurred to secure, find and secure the mail. For instance, after 9/11, a lot of people don't realize the Church Street Post Office was right across the street from some of the buildings and sustained some pretty heavy damage. That day, the postal inspectors were there with trucks to basically unload all the mail that they could from Church Street and secure it. So while everything else was going on, they're in the middle of making sure the mail's safe.
Let's take another call. Josephine, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I'm a dinosaur, and first of all, I want to caution people about going digital because you're going to have a lot of people on unemployment if you do that.
But that's a whole other issue.
Yeah. Well, it's a big
there are 60,000 jobs that have been lost just in the last 2 years.
Yeah, but here's my question. I still have old stamps, and once in a while I use them. I just used one today. There's a 41-cent stamp, and I put on a 4-cent stamp. Now, is the machine going to realize I have put 45 cents on there?
You will using those stamps. Stamp tagging started in the 1960s. So as long as you're using those stamps, you're fine. And quite honestly, you can even use stamps from before that. If the machine can't recognize the tagging, it will get kicked out, and somebody by hand will look at it. And, you know, they know which stamps are good and which aren't.
Well, although I would think that if you have a stamp that predates 1960, you want to hold on to it for other reasons, because that's the kind of stamp that stamp collectors like.
It depends, to be honest with you. 20th century stamps have been so widely collected that it takes an era usually to be really valuable. Mostly they're collected for the love of the images and the love of collecting.
Although the post office, it seems to be, used to spend, put more of an effort to sell big sheets of collectible stamps than they do today. I guess fewer people are collecting stamps. But we have to end it here. Unfortunately, it's been so much fun talking with both of you. Nancy Pope is a history department curator at the Smithsonian National Postal Museum. You might want to go see the new show called Systems at Work. And Richard John is the author of two books about postal service. Thank you both so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
On Monday's show, we will cover the presidential inauguration with Jonathan Capehart, plus Frank Rich, Todd Purdom, and Joan Walsh look at some of the key challenges facing President Obama as he embarks on his second term. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Michik, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Agency Executive Producer. We had help today from Wendy Blake, Lindsay Hodges, and contributing producer Bonnie LeFave. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.